thank you very much, and welcome all to this last event of the CMRS series for this year. It is my pleasure and indeed my honor to introduce our speaker today, Professor George Floch. Before I do that, though, I'd like to thank Professors Richard Green and Sarah Grace Heller for very graciously embracing this event in their terrific series. I also like to thank them for their sponsorship and the Department of Spanish and Portuguese for also co-sponsoring it through a grant that we get from Portugal's Instituto de Camões. For those of you who don't know this institution, it's Portugal's answer to, we could put it that way, Portugal's answer to the Instituto Cervantes or the Alliance Française or the Goethe Institute. And when I say Portugal's answer, we should be speaking in proportional terms. It's a modest institution, and therefore, we're, especially in these times of austerity, we're very, very fortunate to have gotten this grant. So again, I'm very grateful for their co-sponsorship of the event. So Professor George Floch is professor of history of European colonial and post-colonial systems at the European University Institute in Florence, Italy. Before that, from 2007 to 2010, I believe, he taught history of the Portuguese discoveries at Brown University, where, I should say, is still sorely missed. And I know that for a fact. Professor Flores has a PhD in history from the New University of Lisbon, summa cum laude. His research focuses on the history of the Portuguese Empire during the early modern period, and he's particularly interested in the interaction between the Portuguese society and extra-European cultures, as well as in the formation of cross-cultural images and representations. He is presently completing a book entitled Between Intelligence and Ethnography, Portuguese Perceptions of the Mughal Empire, circa 1570-1670, which explores relevant articulations between political and cultural history where the construction of European images of the Indo-Persian world is concerned. Two other of his current research projects are entitled Portuguese Empire and Eurasian Cosmopolitanism, 1500 to 1700. And another one that really caught my attention and I want to hear all about it later is Lettered Empires, Cartographies of Writing in the Iberian Overseas World from 1400 to 1800. I have to say that perusing Professor Flores's CV is an exercise in humility, and I'll do my best to spare you from it. But I will nonetheless mention some of his publications. Some recent ones are The Inverted Mirror, Asian Images of the Europeans, from 1500 to 1800. This was published in Lisbon by the Centro Científico e Cultural de Macau in 2007. A co-edited volume, I believe, called Re-Exploring the Links, History and Constructive Histories Between Portugal and Sri Lanka, which was published in Wiesbaden in Germany in 2007. And another co-edited volume, which Professor Flores is co-edited with Rudy Matthey, Portugal, the Persian Gulf, and Safavid Persia, published in Belgium, actually, it's listed as forthcoming. I don't know if
it's already published.
He also has another noteworthy publication called, he has many, but one that I will mention, is 500 Years of Relations Between Portugal and Sri Lanka, published again in Lisbon by the Orient Foundation in 2001. And he's been since 2006 the co-editor of the series Maritime Asia, which is published in Wiesbaden in Germany. He's been so far responsible for volumes 17 to 20. Professor Flores has also edited several historical sources of Portugal's presence in Asia. and has been guest editor of several special issues of journals such as Oceanus, which was a monumental journal that the Portuguese Commission at the commemoration of the Portuguese discoveries published for about a decade. And he has articles, chapters, book chapters, and exhibition catalogs that are too numerous for me to mention. I will just ask you to please join me in giving a warm welcome to Professor John Thorpe.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your very kind introduction, Pedro. You can say Flores because my grandfather was Spanish, so it can be Flores and Flores if you want. And I'm very glad to be here. I'm actually honored to be here. Thank you very much, Richard and Sarah, for the very kind invitation and for the financial support for that. I think Pedro and Lisa most probably suggested my name and the support of the Instituto Camões, which is an institution I know well from Lisbon. So what I'd like to do today, I'm not a specialist of Portuguese cartography. There's a sort of long tradition of people in Portugal doing the history of cartography, actually with sometimes non-professional historians, people coming from other areas of knowledge. And perhaps if you are not acquainted to this kind of production, with this kind of production, I would say that monumental Portugalia, Monumenta Cartográfica in 5 volumes, which I most probably will have in your library, it's the most impressive and the most important work on Portuguese cartography. It was published in 1960, and with a second edition, a bit more poor from the visual aspect, in 1987. So it's something to have in mind. But I think that the kind of cartography I'm bringing here today is slightly different. I mean, in a way, I'm trying to simplify this and to make a sort of distinction between the rich cartography you find in that impressive collection, which is very, very much institutional, right? Looking at specific prominent cartographers, families of cartographers, because it's sort of knowledge that passes from one generation to the other. And the kind of maps that I'm, and other images, but especially the maps that I'm bringing here, I would call them poor cartography, something that it's not represented in the Portugalia Monumenta Cartográfica. Some of them are not very, very well known. And you cannot trace this kind of institutional cartography and link these people to a sort of network of families close to power and so forth. So the geographical space of my talk has to do with what the Portuguese called the Estado da Índia, or the State of India, which was created in 1505. And it was a long political reality, political entity. It ended up in 1961 with the so-called invasion, fall, occupation, whatever you want to call it, of Goa in 1961. So it's a long political entity. I'm interested in the 16th, the 17th, and the 18th centuries, most of that. And it's a very loose, for the ones who don't have any sort of background on the Portuguese Empire in Asia, it's a very loose territorial and maritime space. It started actually in East Africa. It was part of the State of India, what is today the ex-Portuguese colony of Mozambique. And it ended up in the South China Sea, between China and Japan. So this was the space of the Portuguese State of India, and you see some of the maps have to do with this, and my images have to do with this space. And it was ruled from the capital city of the Estado da Índia, which was created in 1510, and it's the city of Goa in India. So the ones traveling to India for sure either have been to Goa or heard about Goa and the society, the unique society of Goa, halfway between sort of Portuguese society, local society, even in terms of language, is a bit complex social and political reality. So the viceroys were based in Goa. The Portuguese viceroys were based in Goa since 1510. And later in the 19th century, they start being called governors, not really viceroys anymore. So the last governor was 1961. Actually, the grandfather of a friend of mine who is today specialist of art history and works at the Gulbenkian Museum. He's the deputy director of the Gulbenkian Museum. With whom I have curated an exhibition called "Go in the Great Mughal." If I have something to, if there's a title that I really like, it's this one. It's a sort of catalog edited volume, which I think was an important exhibition in international, even in international context. So, for an example of rich cartography, you have, for example, this one, the so-called Atlas Müller or Müller Atlas, 1519. This is a section of it. It's a bit, still a bit medieval. You see, apparently this was, there's a recent study on this by Luis Filipe Tomás, a former professor of mine in Lisbon, and he traces all the political, imperial implications of this map. Apparently this was a gift from King Manuel in the early 16th century, 1519. He ruled up to 1591, to Francis I. And so this is the kind of official cartography, very imperial, very visibly, from a visual perspective, very strong. It doesn't help you circulate in the Indian Ocean. That's not, it's not meant for that. But it helps you to impress your European partners, your European, other European kings. And it's clearly one of those examples. You see Portuguese flags in different parts of the map. This is only a section. And you have, if again, if you look at the Portugalia Monumenta Cartográfica, you will find many maps like this one. The materials I'm interested in are a bit different in many senses. First of all, they are like this one; they are manuscript materials, which are not in big collections. They are not in big museums or in big European or North American collections. They have, and this manuscript character of my images today, both maps and iconography, it's crucial to understand some of the things I would like to underline. Because in visual culture of this period, there's a sort of link, sort of connection that people like to explore, which has to do with this passage from picture to engraving, right? And how pictures are transformed in this process, and how something that someone on the spot, either in Virginia in the 17th century or in Japan in the same period, have outlined as a true Japanese person, and becomes a different thing once you get to Europe, and engravers of especially Northern Europe looked at these things and tried to adapt them to sort of European audience, which was keen on looking at this from a perspective, which is really an Western perspective with some exotic elements. So in the images I have, you don't have this kind of circulation, you don't have this kind of process, because my pictures, the pictures I bring here, never became engravings, and so you cannot trace this kind of connection. And not that they didn't circulate, but they were not targeting a sort of European audience as, for example, Théodore de Brie and other engravers and publishers of the 17th century looking at similar images. Then I would also like to underline the hybrid character of many of my images, not again this one. In terms of authorship, sometimes it's difficult to say, and I'd like to elaborate a bit more on that later on. Who is the author of this? If the author is European, if this really represents an European attitude, an European depiction of any other part of the world, because sometimes you have authors themselves who are hybrid, are go-betweens, people who were born in Southeast Asia, and I have examples of that, with a Malay mother and a Portuguese father, speaking Malay and speaking Portuguese, connecting to different parts, to different cultural zones of that area. So you cannot really say to what extent this represents a sort of European a European perspective of a certain part of the world. And on the other hand, you, and it's something very fashionable today, it's very, and it's especially well known for Spanish Empire, you have sort of strong intervention, strong agency of native cartographies, of native painters in the process of building, of constructing a European map. Right. And in that case, you don't know where is the divide, what is the native element and the European element in a certain map. And this is very clear in the maps, and this was actually dealt with by, for example, Barbara Mundi in a book on the Relaciones Geográficas of the Spanish, and how the maps which are attached to these Relaciones Geográficas have a very strong intervention of native painters and native artists. So to what extent, and this is colonial knowledge, right? This is something that was written and meant to be digested one in Madrid and for Philip II to know what was going on in Mexico and Peru. And you have a very strong intervention, very strong agency, a sort of very strong native agency in those maps, right? And the book by Barbara Mundi is, I think, crucial to understand that aspect. So you have sort of biological and cultural go-betweens, in a way molding and shaping the kind of maps and images that we take for granted that are Europeans and not really such. Another aspect that I would like to underline has to do with the connected and global character of some of these Portuguese views. Not that they are all of them systematically global, but the point I'd like to make is that this idea of observing and depicting and reporting about the other is not sort of European prerogative. That is, it's not only the Europeans who observe the others. The others also observe the Europeans, and perhaps more importantly, the other itself observes the Asians, for example, observe themselves. An Indian may observe a Chinese may depict the Japanese, and you have some common threads in this mutual process of observation. It's and it's this idea that it's only the European who observes the other. It's a bit tricky. On the one hand, it loses, I think, the specificities and the political context of this observation. You have to know a bit about Asian history and Asian societies to, in this case, in my case, to make those sorts of connections. And it becomes often sort of intellectual as a size of European history. It's about European history and intellectual history of Europe. And what I'd like to do here today is something different. It's something that tries to emphasize the very specific political circumstances once in Asia of this kind of interactions. Right? So it has more to do what is going on in Asia and less to do with engravers, decision makers and in Madrid or in Northern Europe, and the kind of things that people dealing with visual culture and the engravings on the New World once in Europe, and the way they travel, the way they target certain markets. And I will, in the last section of my talk, I will try to emphasize this idea, looking at the ways in which different societies in the world think about savages, right, which is a big topic on the European perspective and European perception of the New World, but it's also a big topic regarding other societies depicting another society. So it's something to have in mind. It is, I think, rather difficult to classify the materials I'm bringing, and some of them I know better. Some others I've recently discovered them. Actually also physically discovered them. So to illustrate this kind of complexity, let me call your attention to this person, Manuel Godinho de Heredia. He was, his father was Portuguese, his mother was Malay. He was born in the early 1560s in Malacca, and he died in Goa in 1623. I'm not going to elaborate on him, but I think I actually have a sort of side project on this character in this very interesting intellectual production. And he's a bit of everything. He studied with the Jesuits. He has a very strong intellectual European background on the one hand. once in Goa, he had access to the library of the Jesuits, so he was very... We know from the kind of things he wrote, mostly geographical treatises, that he's very solid from that perspective. But he also has sort of very privileged access to what we call the Malay world or insular Southeast Asia. He speaks Malay. He resorts on oral traditions of that part of the world from Malacca. He knows written sources also from the Malay world. So he tries to combine both cultural traditions. And you see that in a very clear way in many of his writings. So he does a bit of everything. All his works were never published until the 19th century, so there's no any sort of connection to the printed world of the 16th and 17th century. And he was a bit of everything. He was a cartographer, plenty of maps like this, and this sort of Ptolemy's vision of the Hindustan with a boat. And actually, he likes to depict different boats of different parts of the Indian Ocean in his maps. So this is one example. Then he's also able to do this. Malay warrior, when he speaks about war systems in insular Southeast Asia, he gives an example of a Malay warrior and he describes the Malay warrior, but he's also capable of this, which is very different. Sort of grotesque figure that winged people that he says that are to be found in what is today more or less Bangladesh, right? That part of Mughal India by this time, the province of Bengal, which was really the end of the world for the Mughals. If a Mughal official was to be placed in Bengal, he would beg the emperor not to go, for many reasons. And also because fantasies, very, very fantastic creatures and figures are to be found in this area of the world. And Heredia took this from this kind of sources. So he depicts people, gente da Ilha de Zanzi, and so it's very different materials from the things we saw before. He also does that. He has a book, he becomes a sort of botanist, amateur botanist. He has a book which was actually recently, about 10 years ago, discovered by a Flemish scholar who published that actually in Portugal. So, Suma de Árvores e Plantas da Índia entre Ganges, one of the most recently discovered books by Heredia, so around 50 images of different plants and medical use of those plants, of some of them. This is the mango tree, it's not the case. But he's also capable of this. He became a chronicler at some point, a set of three violent images. And he's very interested in martyrdom. Not really the religious martyrdom of the Jesuits and other missionaries that we know well from other sources. But he was close to the family of this Luis Monteiro Coutinho, who died in the Sultanate of Aceh. The Sultanate of Aceh is today part of Indonesia, actually one of the part in the island of Sumatra or Sumatra, in the northern tip of the island. And it's... actually a very strong sultanate in the 16th, 17th centuries, very much against the Portuguese conquest and control of Malacca, which was a sort of twin city. And still today, you have a very strong independence movement in Aceh. Sometimes you see that in the news. So this Luis Monteiro Coutinho, as a Portuguese noble, who became a captive of the Sultan of Aceh, and his brother asked Heredia to write about this. So he wrote this book. And again, drawings and images are crucial to the ways in which Heredia expresses himself. So together with the text, you have a very interesting set of images. I brought three, where he explains this sort of civil martyrdom. The Sultan was pushing Coutinho and other Portuguese people there, captives, to convert to Islam, and they refused that. So they were killed in very violent ways, as you see, with elephants, and then in front of a cannon, and then you see the Sultan of Aceh there riding an elephant. And finally, this one, when Saída do Tronco, it's when he goes out of the prison, and he fights again against someone riding an elephant, and he tries to defend himself. So, and you have more images like this. So basically, this is the book. So it's very difficult to classify Heredia and his work. Right? You can say he's a cartographer, he's a mathematician, he's a geographer, he's interested in mineralogy, he does this, he's also interested in fantastic creatures and old legends about the Malay world. So how do we classify him? It's not only a cartographer, it's much more than that. And the ways in which he tries to connect to political power in both first Philip II and then Philip III is also very, it's very telling and very, very, very interesting. So this is a way, by way of introduction, I'd like to call your attention to two or three things that are important to understand the three main themes that I would like to explore. The first one is the relationship between what we could call poor cartography, poor maps, less impressive maps also from the visual point of view, iconography, which is sometimes associated or not with those maps, and what one could call ethnographic literature of this period, 16th, 17th, early 18th centuries. And here I think it's crucial to understand the importance of what, and a lot of people here doing Spanish history, colonial Latin America, what by this period is called arbitrios, this literature of arbitrios. People who give opinions to the king or to the Count Duke of Olivares, for example, on a number of issues. And I think the most popular ones, the most well-known and more well-researched, are the ones who have to do with the financial situation of the kingdom. What to do regarding finances, how to shape the empire in the kingdom from the perspective of the economy. This is very, there's a lot of literature on this. But at some point, I became curious, and now I'm trying to also do the history of this project in a way. The first time I thought about this was when I presented in Florence in a meeting we had on literature and empire, I think, about 10 years ago. And I did the sort of first venture when Lisa was there too on this kind of material, because you come across a number of people arguing the same way. There's a sort of structure for the ones who know the arbiters. I'll be briefer. Right? You have someone who think is very experienced in a particular aspect, a particular map, can be finances or any other thing, and puts that experience at the service of the king. So he presents a project to solve the problem. Austerity, for example, would be a good example. And he says, this is the solution. And of course, he is looking at patronage, he's looking at social status, a number of things. And usually, this is framed as a sort of remedy. If you follow, this is a remedy for the empire. And if you buy this, the kingdom will have all this its problems solved. And of course, I will also be rich in the end because you have to recompense me. You have to reward me. So the literature of arbitrios works this way, and the kind of phrasing is like this. Remedies, I have the experience, I have the authority, I've been there, I know, so sort of a very strong authoritative element in this kind of literature. And at some point I became very interested in what we could call ethnographical arbitrios. People who are not arguing about the different kingdoms within Spain and finances and things like that, but are arguing in favor, for example, of the conquest of Cambodia in the late 16th century, in the period of the Iberian Union when Portugal and Spain had the same king, and saying if you conquer Cambodia, you'll be the richest king in the world. And then he explains, because I lived here for 10 years, I was a captive, I know the rivers, I know everything, I know the people, I know the court, and we have a plan. There's a lot of literature on this, because usually it relates to projects, very utopian projects of territorial conquests. Even China was considered as something that could be added to Philip II's empire at some point. And so these arbitristas, and they are called that way, the ones who deal with the empire, and I'm dealing with the ones who have to do with the Asian section of the empire, follow the same kind of recipe. This is the remedy for the empire. If you do this, the empire will be safe, will be strong economically, and so on. And usually what I came across is that some of these texts were in the period, in the 16th, 17th century, would be written and put together with maps. Because when you read this text, and you don't have the maps anymore today, but when you read the text, you see that they were constructed around a map, around the visual component of the Advit. And they say, and for this, look at the map. So most probably the king looked at the map, but the historian in the 21st century doesn't have the opportunity. I have a number of examples. I won't want to explore them. But there's a volume of this actually published, but it's the original is in the National Library in Madrid. And for example, one of these texts on the Amazon River, it's actually not to do with Asia, it is 3 pages describing the map. So you don't have the map, but the author takes 3 pages to explain the map. And interestingly, he's interested in native knowledge, and it's something that I'd like to explore a bit later. He says, firstly, I inform that all the names that in this map are in red color are in the form given by the Indian savages. And I have similar examples for Asia, where they give the precise outline of certain rivers in the South China Sea, the southern part of China, and they resort to Chinese knowledge. They speak about that specifically. So most probably, many of these arbitrios were to be read together with a map, and to be a map that Philip II and Philip III for sure had access to, and we don't have it anymore. A good, interesting example is more than an arbitrio, something more perhaps more solid, is a book that doesn't exist today, so I don't have anything to show you, but it is listed in Leon Pinello in 1629, has been written, at least I think compiled, not really written, by a Portuguese noble called Mauro de Rocha, who was secretary of the State of India in the late 16th century. And it was called Anfiteatro Oriental, sort of Oriental Theater, and it was like this, where are shown the portraits of all the viceroys and governors of India since the Portuguese arm was incorporated in the Castilian head. A life model and plan of all the fortresses with their districts and all the fleets that the kings of Portugal have sent to India, and this is, I think, important, with the pictures of all the nations and their particular emblems, variety of colors, their professions, abomination of their rites, bestiality of their customs, and finally the most notable plants with their virtues and properties, and most of them examined in the presence of Viceroy Matias Alquer, who was Viceroy for 6 years in the last decade of the 16th century. So what you have, so we don't have this book. We have a 1629 description of a book which was compiled about 30 years before, earlier, and it's, I think, a very interesting piece because it combines a number of different genres within what the Portuguese did in terms of writing and visualizing Asia in the 16th, 17th century. He has a bit of this. So this is when he says he has all the fleets, for sure it was something like this. This is the famous book of Lisuarte de Abreu, which is today at the Morgan Library, giving you the successive fleets going to Asia in the early 16th century. The book is from around the early 1560s. So this is for sure one of the components of that book because it is mentioned. Then it had plans of cities and fortresses, which is something that became crucial visual material in the first 20, 30 years of the 17th century. With Philip II, Philip III, and still Philip IV, to rule the empire, they wanted to see plans of cities and fortresses of Asia. And you have at least 6-7 books of this kind in the period, and I myself have published one on Sri Lanka, which I will show you soon. And then when dealing with the nations, the professions, the customs, and the rites, and the religion, and superstitions, most probably had something like this, which some of you may know. It's the so-called Casanatense Codex. It's at the library, Casanatense Library in Rome today. It's a wonderful set, sort of pictorial grammar of Portuguese Asia, starting, like the State of India, in East Africa, and going up to China, it doesn't include Japan. So we don't know much about this. It was published both in Italy and in Portugal in the 1980s. What we know is most probably this was commissioned by a Portuguese noble, and most probably with native artists painting the successive images from East Africa to Japan. And my colleague and friend Sanjay Subramaniam is convinced it's someone from Gujarat, which is a northwestern part of India. So, and I give you another example, the Sinhala women from Sri Lanka, also included in the same Kazanatense codex. So, most probably the book by Mauro Rocha had something of this kind, and it's, I think, important to have that in mind. And then botanical knowledge of the kind that I've shown you with Heredia. This is another thing. This is my next example and something I'd like to explore here. It has to do with the books, the tradition of books of cities and fortresses. And at some point, I came across this book on which doesn't have a title. It's only on Sri Lanka, written in 1638 by a man, sort of veteran soldier. He's not an intellectual. He's someone who stayed as a soldier in Sri Lanka for 3 decades. His name is Constantino Sá de Miranda, not Sá de Miranda, the poet of the previous century. And it's in the University Library of Zaragoza in Spain. And so what you have here, the examples I brought have nothing to do with Portuguese fortresses and cities, but to native cities and other native aspects that I would like to underline. And in a way, this can be titled and named as an arbitrio. Sá de Miranda wants to show Philip IV that he knows a lot about Sri Lanka. He has not only the experience of 30 years of war there, but also access to privileged native knowledge about the island. And this is expressed in some of the illustrations that are together with the writing. This is the city of Kandy, which became the capital, the most important kingdom in this period in Sri Lanka. And there's a book by a scholar from Cambridge on the urban outline of Kandy from the 17th century onwards, and pretty much matches what Constantino Sá de Miranda was doing in 1638. So this is the city, and this is the citadel. If you go to Kandy today, you can still have a sort of sense of the citadel of the 1638. And where you see here pagodas, it are the temples that were destroyed by the Portuguese captain general of the island. And he also depicts that. And then he moves to from the type of depiction of the typology of depiction of cities to other aspects like Adam's Peak. I don't know if you heard of this or if you have been to Sri Lanka. This is according to tradition, on top of this mountain, which is really high, there's the footprint of Buddha. So this is one of the relics and one of the sacred places of Buddhism, and people come here in pilgrimage also today, up to nowadays. And according to different religions, people, for example, the Hindus say that there's the Shiva footprint on top. It's not the Buddha's one. So the interesting thing about Constantino Sá de Miranda is that he gives this, it is the first European depiction of, although Marco Polo already spoke about this, it's the first European depiction of Adam's Peak, and he says that he went there for twice. Once because he had to go, I don't know, for war purposes, I think, and another one just to see, so sort of tourism in the 17th century. I was really interested in depicting and elaborating on Adam's Peak, which is today more or less this. So you don't see the Buddha footprint in the next slide, but this is how it looks. It's never tried. It's very difficult to get to the top. And then he matches that first depiction with this one, with the footprint itself. And he says all sorts of terrible things about Buddhism. it's a very interesting combination of curiosity and also prejudice. Right? He's curious to know more about this, to depict, to write, to visualize, but at the same time he's criticizing heavily, actually says that Buddhists are worse than Muslims in different parts of his book. And this is more or less actually the one with the Buddhist monk is the real Buddha footprint on top of Adam's Peak, and the other one is I think it's in the British Museum, but also only to give you an idea, these are relics for the Buddhists in different parts of Asia, and so Saad Miranda was keen on exploring this topic, and he says, I'm going to read briefly what he writes. One captive of those who have been in this kingdom of candy, with abundant knowledge of the art of painting, gave me the form of the island as I'm sending it to you now. He's writing to Philip IV. And it has less errors than the others. And then he goes on criticizing other people like Antonio Bucarro, who is a famous Portuguese, has a very famous Portuguese book of Cities and Fortresses, also depicting some in Sri Lanka. And he makes the comparison and distinction. He says, you know, mines are much better because are supported by my own experience and my privileged access to people who have been to these places as captives, for example, with knowledge of the art of painting. And this is another, this is the overall big depiction of the island of Sri Lanka, with, I think, the first depiction of this city here, which is Anuradhapura. If you go to Sri Lanka today, it's part of a UNESCO triangle of royal, imperial, royal sacred cities of Sri Lanka, and this is the most ancient one. And he depicts that. I think it's perhaps the first European depiction of Anuradhapura. So this, I think, it's important to show this connection between cartography, iconography, and examples of things that circulated, but to a limited extent, and have very little to do with the printing world. The next theme that I would like to explore has to do with something that I said in the introduction, has to do with the hybrid nature of some of these materials. And to explore this, I will look at cryptography, but also at some other visual materials which I think are important. So let's look at the city of Macau in the mid-17th century as represented in the so-called book of Antonio Bucarro and painted by Pedro Barreto Rezende. I'm not going to explore all the names because people will be at some point confused with too many Portuguese names, but this is a sort of classic of books of cities and fortresses, 1635. So very popular depiction of Macau in this period. And what we know from, especially from the work of a Portuguese young historian of cartography, that this image traveled in China and became a sort of template for Chinese depictions of Macau, like this one. It's very close to the what he calls the Rezende map and the Rezende model, right? And we know, we explore that, I already knew that too, that at some point, when the Portuguese start sending embassies to Beijing in the 1660s, one of them for sure, one of the presents, one of the gifts that was brought to the Chinese emperor was a depiction of Macau. And he makes that connection. He says that most probably this depiction was something like the Rezende map, and this embassy is from the early 1670s. So this is in a library or an archive in Beijing, this map and other maps of the same kind. So he makes that comparison and that connection. Most probably from the Portuguese embassy to Beijing in the 1670s, this became sort of popular way of depicting Macau using Portuguese cartography as such. The other example also on Macau is also, I think, very interesting. It's an arbitrio, so you have a text that comes together with this map. So when I said that sometimes we have the text, we don't have the maps anymore, this, I think, is one of the few examples when you can combine two, the both. So this Jorge Pintas Vedo was someone living in Macau in the 1640s. He wrote one of these arbitrios saying that the remedy for the empire is Macau and Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka for a number of reasons that we don't have time to explore. And he gives all sorts of solutions to deal with this, with these two places. And he systematically calls the king's attention, already John IV, the first king of the Braganza dynasty, to the map. And the map is this one. This is in Lisbon at the Ajuda Library. And again, it was recently studied by Francisco Roque de Oliveira, this historian of cartography. It's clearly a Chinese map. It has very little to do with... We have Portuguese names in it. But this you see Macau here. This area here, and you see Canton there. So this is the Pearl River Delta and the complex of the River Delta. And usually Portuguese maps do not put this kind of emphasis on the territory itself. Much more maritime than this. And if you look at Chinese maps of South China, they are very, very close to this. It's something that when I saw this map for the first time, I think I had that impression because I knew some Chinese maps of the same kind. And then it was important that Francisco wrote extensively on this map, actually emphasizing this connection between a Chinese model of maps and what Jorge Pinto de Azevedo did. So most probably, Azevedo wrote the text for sure, but the map is not his own production. Most probably, he resorted on someone in Macau, a Chinese people in Macau, that drew the map in around 1646. My second example has to do with this Jesuit account of the Kingdom of Laos in the mid-17th century. Again in Lisbon at the Ajuda Library. And it depicts the Mekong River with a number of indications on different communities from south to north. And again, it's not rich cartography, something that I came across by accident when looking at this collection on Jesuit materials on Asia in the Ajuda Library. And if you compare this with this, you see some connection. This is a map from published, the image is not very good, but you see it was published in the History of Cartography, published by the University of Chicago Press. And as some of you may know, there's a number of volumes, one on Southeast Asia as a chapter on Vietnam. And you see the same way of depicting the river, the same way of looking at the water, the same orientation from south to north, the same centrality of the Mekong River Delta, and for clear, I think there's a connection here. I think the person who wrote on Vietnamese cartography, I don't think he knows this map, and I'm not a historian of cartography myself, but I see a connection between the two models of depiction of the Mekong River. And we don't have that many maps on the Portuguese maps on this part of the world. Two more books to explore in a brief way, so that we have some time to conclude and that to look at discuss possible questions. And has to do with this the so-called Boxer Codex. Some of you may know that this became very popular recently. There's a Wikipedia entry explaining what the Boxer Codex is, if you are interested. And in the Philippines, they are now producing their own stamps for the mail with this kind of images. So some 10 years ago, no one knew about this. Now it's becoming popular. But in a very, very briefly, the Boxer Codex was owned by Charles Boxer, who was a very important English scholar of the Portuguese Empire throughout the 20th century, wrote a number of books and articles, namely the Portuguese Seaborne Empire. And he also collected books and manuscripts. And all that collection is now in Bloomington, at the Lilly Library in Indiana. And this is also there. No one really wrote about this, apart from Boxer. He wrote, when he bought this in an auction in 1947, he wrote an article on what became the Boxer Codex, explaining what it was, and this was published in 1950. And after that, I really, there's a sort of, as I said, people are, in the internet, you'll find a lot of images from the Boxer Codex, but there's no specialist, either a cartographer, someone on visual culture, or historian, dealing with that. It's again a collection of arbitrios. You will find, for example, a famous project of conquest of the Sultanate of Aceh there. You have descriptions of New Guinea. You have descriptions of Siam. So you have a number of ethnographical written materials there, sort of collection of, by different authors, sometimes anonymous, which is normal. This way of combining very different materials, but with a very strong visual component. You have almost 300 drawings like this, watercolor like this. And so I brought some images only to explore them with you. What, from the 5-6 that I have here, it's important to note is that Manila appears here as a sort of door to the other part of Southeast Asia and the South China Sea. So from Manila, the artist or the artists are interested in depicting people that have connections, commercial networks, personal and family connections with other parts of the Southeast Asian world. So it starts with, of course, with the Filipinos, it's Naturales, Tagalog. And this is crucial, is the one of the representations of the so-called Sangles. Sangles are the Chinese immigrants in the Philippines. Then sometimes they became mestizos, in this period less so. And there's a lot of literature on the role of the Sangles in the Philippines and the ways in which the colonial power of the Spanish tried to tame them and to control them, also spatially within the structure of the city of Manila. There's a number of rebellions of Chinese against the Spanish. So this is a hot topic in Manila in the 16th, 17th century. And most probably these images were drew by a Sangle, by a Chinese. And this is the impression that Boxer has, and I think I would also tend to agree with him. Then you have the Siamese, people from Thailand. Then you have from the Moluccas, also part of Indonesia today, and the Japanese, and that's it. This is something to explore later. So it's like if you study any of these sultanates or port cities like Malacca, which became Portuguese in 1511, you understand how they are connected to a number of other parts of Southeast Asia. And in a way, visually, the author is doing the same. It's connecting people from the Philippines with a number of people who are really very strongly attached to Manila and to a number of port cities in the region. So the Boxer Codex, there's an the article by Boxer is, I think, very, although written in 1950, I think is very very clear on the hybridity of this piece. And quote briefly two or three lines of his text. It's a mixture of Eastern and Western influence in the colored drawings and their decorative borders. The text seemed to be written by a Spanish or possibly a Filipino clerk. Written, I mean, sort of the scribe himself. But the illustrations in all probability are the work of a Chinese artist. The use of Chinese paper, ink, and paints also suggests a Chinese artist. We know from the correspondence of the first bishop of Manila that in 1590 there were several Christian Chinese artists who painted devotional pictures for the local churches and monasteries. The Chinese influence in the colored drawings of this manuscript is clearly tempered by the use of several Western forms. And this holds true also for Goa. We know there's a lot of Indian artists in Goa working for the Portuguese, working in the churches. And with Counter-Reformation, this became more complicated because there were restrictions on this kind of freedom, how to see sacred objects from an Indian perspective, from a native perspective, but that's another thing. The last example before the conclusion and what I would like to say on savages has to do with something I came across very recently in Madrid, which is, let's call it the Madrid Codex, which is a collection of about 40 images, again, watercolors, drawings, late 17th, early 18th century, with no text apart from the captions you see there. So these 40 images, some of them actually do not have any captions. But the majority has 2, 3, 4 lines on something. And it has a lot to do with the visual program explained by Mauro da Rocha. You remember The Oriental Theater, the book that doesn't exist, but we have the description, where he says, with the pictures all of all these people, their professions, occupations, religion, superstitions, and so forth. So the topics are very much the same. So here you have the acrobats, bailarinos y bailarinas de corda, you know, the sort of carousel. Then you have a number of professions. I brought only four or five. The religious aspect, which is a sort of also a classic thing, the Hindu cremation. Also a classical topic, the holy man of India, sannyasis or penitents, with all sorts of difficult exercises. It's also a trope. And then a number of professions, carpenters, shoemaker, a sort of grotesque figure here, barbers. We can go back if you want, it's just to iron makers, fishermen, a banker, it's more affluent than the shoemaker. And that's it. This is something, again, to explore on savages. So, we know very little about this. I came across this last year. I talked to some people, and I was reading and discussing this with Subramanyam, because he recently worked on someone. I didn't bring images from his book, by a Venetian called Manucci, Niccolo Manucci, who came to India in the late 17th, the same period, late 17th century, early 18th century. And he has two books, the so-called Libro Nero and Libro Rosso, the book, the red book, the black book and the red book. And the book itself, the manuscript itself, has a long story. As part of it are in Venice, others in Berlin, others in Paris. Sanjay explores this aspect in his book chapter. But it's clearly the same kind of generation of images. They are very, very, very close to what Manucci has. Manucci has these two books. One deals with Mughal India, with the north, which is a different, and this is clearly South India. Right? So he has a book on North India, Mughal India, and he has the black book on South India, and especially because he lived in Madras, which is today Chennai, the city of Chennai. And Sanjay argues that most probably these images were made by local artists who were used to paint textiles. Textile production in India, this region, is still very strong. And he makes that sort of link. Again, it's second-rate artists. We are not speaking about the artists working for the Mughal emperors of Akbar and Jahangir's court. This is a different thing, with very strong connections to the Persian elite and very, very influential people also from the political point of view. This is a different thing. This is very interesting to see, but it's not refined as the so-called Mughal miniatures. And it's very interesting. It's a pity that I didn't bring, with so many images, I didn't bring Manucci, but it's published, and if you want, I can give you the reference. And it's a very, not only in the kind of the style of the images, but also the program, the visual program itself. Again, religion, the sannyasis or the holy man are very, very present in the book by Manucci. The professions, so they have very much, we have a lot of similarities between the work of Manucci. Actually, it's not, the images were not made by Manucci himself. He commissioned local artists for sure. And this is something I know very little about, because it's, you cannot see that there, but the captions are written in Spanish. So this is from South India for sure, late 17th, early 18th century. No Spanish people there, no Spanish colony there. But they are written in Spanish, and the other day I was reading something which is at the National Library in Madrid, which is a very interesting fictional dialogue between an Armenian and a Spanish about the Philippines and about the power of the Chinese, the so-called sangres. This is late 17th century. And at some point, one of them, I don't recall if it is the Spanish guy or the Armenian guy, he says, last year, I'm translating from the Spanish, last year I saw in Madras, Chennai, that they, I don't know who, have sent one history, so one book, of history, I don't know of what, in Dibujo, for the Indians of Manila to paint it. And with this example, one can see how skillful they are. So he's talking about how the Indians, the Filipinos, which are depicted in the previous codex, how skillful they are. And he says that I was in Chennai last year, and the connections between the so-called Coromandel Coast in southeast coast of India and the Malay world were strong since before the arrival of the Portuguese. So there's a strong commercial connection between what is today Chennai and what is today Singapore, for example. So he says that a book was sent from Madras, most probably a sort of commission of a European, to Manila to be painted by the Indians, and most presumably back to Chennai later, to Madras later. So, and again, this I think adds something to the complexity of the materials we are dealing with. We don't know why the captions are in Spanish, but this I think this example of the fictional dialogue can add something to that. I would conclude with something on savages, and then perhaps we can, from the images, we can talk more about that later on. And I go back to my first point on sort of the ways in which one depicts the other is not a privilege of Europeans looking at other people. And this is a point I would like to stress. And I think one looking at savages in different parts of the world and the ways in which civilized people look at savages, I think we come to a sort of common grammar of how to describe and deal with them. And the markers are always the same in different societies. It has to do with the problem, the dress code, or the nakedness. This is one thing. The violent attitude and the warrior attitude is something also to be considered, and you will see that in the images I brought. Also, the hair, sort of loose hair and hairy people is something also very much considered. Sort of grotesque expressions that you see in different people of the same kind, and this sort of lack of manners, which has to do with this opposition of civilized, non-civilized people, or to use the Portuguese word of the 16th, 17th century, people who have policia, or people who don't have policia, right? People who are polished or not. And in the Chinese world, it's more or less the same thing. There's this distinction between people, raw people and cooked people. So the raw people are the ones I'm going to show you with a very interesting mixture of elements and authorship and origin. So going back to the Boxer Codex, natives of Ladrones were the Marianas Islands in this period, actually a sort of stopover for the Manila galleon from Mexico to Manila. So the Ladrones, man and wife, are clearly part of this pictorial tradition. Tattooing, the way you mark your body, is also part of this. You know that also from early American depictions and how the ways they circulate in Europe in the 17th century. This is also from the Boxer Codex on people from the Philippines, more tribal people from the Philippines, so-called negrillos, the zambales. Then more violent stuff here when he opens oxen. And then we move to the Chinese. Feathers is also something, as you know, the feathers from Brazil and the Indians from Brazil. And this is a Chinese depiction, second half of the 18th century, the so-called Miao albums, which were which have been explored by Laura Ostetler, a Chinese scholar from Chicago or Illinois, somewhere not far from us today. She has written extensively on the so-called Miao albums. We can talk a bit more about that later on. This is sort of official Chinese program of description of non-Han people that live within the borders of the empire. This is from Taiwan. There's also a book on this aspect regarding Taiwan, which was full of savages, according to Chinese official minds in the 17th, 18th century. So again, you see them here, or a sort of Japanese equivalent of that. Also 18th century, and perhaps we can finish with going back to the so-called Madrid Codex, and the depiction of the so-called Gentes del Monte. And again, you see feathers, and you see a number of elements that are very much present in other illustrations. So if we do the exercise of comparing depictions of savages of the New World and the ways in which they circulate in Europe and the sort of markers to deal with this kind of people, and if we put that, and they became very important and famous due to very important engravings done later on, if we compare that to the kind of need of other societies, and the case of China is a good one, this distinction between Han people and non-Han people, the raw and cooked, clearly you see that has very little to do with a sort of European distinction on how to depict savages. And I would finalize with sort of interesting connection between savages and gift-giving. Because Laura, in her book, she has two books on the so-called Miao albums. At some point she says that, well, we have a lot of the so-called Miao albums in different parts of the world, even in Italy, in the Geographical Society of Rome, you have some 18th century albums of this kind. And she says that they were crucial element of gift-giving processes in China in the 18th century. And it's interesting because when dealing with a Portuguese embassy to Beijing in the early 18th century, 1720s, by Portuguese ambassador called Alexandre Metelo, it's interesting because he says that a French Jesuit in Beijing gave him, I have the quote here, gave him in Beijing a book of paintings of certain nations that live among the Chinese without giving them obeisance. So it's one of these albums, right? So we received this in Beijing from a Jesuit priest. And it's also funny that once in Canton, before going to Beijing, so usually the Portuguese ambassadors would go from Goa to Macau, from Lisbon to Goa, Goa to Macau, Macau, Canton, and then Beijing. So once in Canton, he had to meet the so-called viceroy of Canton, of Guangdong, and one of the gifts that the Portuguese ambassador gave to this man was a savage man, a living one, a savage man that came from Borneo. So we see that savages became part of the gift-giving process in China in a very clear way, and this clearly connects to some of the images I have shown you just now. So let's stop here and then discuss. Thank you so much.
For those of you who have not been to these talks before, we usually have a fairly brief question and answer period, and then anyone who'd like to, we'll put a couple of tables together and cookies and soft drinks and coffee and just have a more relaxed discussion.
That's
around the table,
idea,
perhaps. Yeah. But if there's someone, anyone has a formal question they'd like to, or two, they'd like to put to our speaker before we do that, we certainly have a little time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you are reading the Chronicles of Don Manuel, we also have the idea of some visitors who get to Lisbon and they get from Don Manuel
gifts like this.
Usually they are Africans who are, given to these visitors, and they say, "Oh, how many do you have?" "Oh, we have many." So
yeah.
I think it is a tradition that comes from early on.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I agree with you. Actually, King Manuel is very keen, and also John II very keen on impressing people with exotic stuff, right?
Uh-huh.
They really understood, I think, both King Manuel and his predecessor, that this was a sort of something that would distinguish Portugal within Europe, this access to this kind of exotic materials and people and the ways in which this was displayed in Lisbon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Reading Damião de Góis in this chronicle of King Manuel, this is very clear,
yeah.
So I agree with you.
Uh-huh.
It's a very strong tradition, I would say.
Do you have the same thing with animals? I mean, are they also bring exotic?
Yes, they do. Yeah, there's this famous fight between an elephant and a rhino in Lisbon, promoted by King Manuel to impress people. And
that's
one. And then you see viceroys asking in India, asking for ferocious animals to bring to Lisbon. Or again, in the gift-giving process, one of these embassies to China, they bring two lions from Mozambique. One of them dies, the other one, the Emperor Kangxi, was really impressed, and one literati from the court in Beijing wrote a poem on him, on the lion. So this was published and explored by John Wills, a Chinese scholar from California, in a book called Embassies and Illusions. And there's an English translation of the poem. Yeah, the exotic animals are also crucial. It's an important aspect.
So at what point does this become scientific, or is it just a curiosity? Or
yeah.
Is there a movement from one to the other?
I think so. Yeah, when you move to the 18th century, I think from the perspective of the materials I have and the Portuguese perspective, there's no scientific revolution here.
Right.
But it's until now, and that's perhaps why I'm interested in that. Until this period, it's collection, display, fostering social ties, political connections, using these kind of things, but not really the need to classify them, to label, to organize them according to sort of 18th century framework, which is not present here, I think.
The drawings of the mango. Aren't they?
Yeah. Well, again, it's a tradition. You have a lot of things like that, but they don't. And actually, Heredia is a sort of amateur botanist, and people sometimes say, "Oh, he put the drawings there, but he doesn't say anything about some." Vulgar things about the qualities of this also the medicinal qualities of some plant. He doesn't really elaborate on that. But then you see also there's a Dutch codex on South Africa of the same kind. They put the plants two lines and that's it, and it's already late 17th century. I don't think there's before the 18th century a sort of real need to classify them. And although you see, for example, one of the first books to be published in Goa was by Garcia d'Horta, who is a famous botanist and doctor, who wrote a very interesting book on actually the ways in which different medical traditions could be connected, the Western one and the Indian one. So this is again it's written in the way of a dialogue as an English and French translation of this, 1563, if I'm not mistaken. And it's clearly a professional that is dealing with this, right? And a professional from a Western model who is very keen on learning Ayurvedic medicine, for example, knowing more about that. But what you get most is this kind of need of depicting exotic stuff but not really elaborating a lot on, at least from the Portuguese materials we have.
I have monopolized this.
Yeah.
I have a question about the Madrid Codex.
Yeah, this
Did
one,
have
right?
A title? Did it,
no.
Was it assigned a title
no,
or
that's
by the library?
I talked to the librarian and she was trying to look at how this got to.
Yeah,
this is in Biblioteca de Real Palacio. And,
it's in the Real Palacio.
Yes, yeah. And so it says Plantas y Dibujos de India Oriental. That's it. And it's not the original title. And
okay.
So when it got to the library, someone decided to put this label.
It makes a lot of sense to think of it as a gift book.
Yeah. So
yeah.
It's something royal in that sense.
So I have another question.
Sure.
Well, I'll think of it in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else has
okay. Or afterwards, if you want.
I have, you know, you put a lot of emphasis on these Albicristas,
mm-hmm.
and during the time of Philip II, and you mentioned Philip III.
Late.
Any special reason why, you know, was just a coincidence that you made a lot of reference about these Albicristas
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
at this time, or was there almost like a political reason
mm-hmm.
to be writing this
yeah.
since there was a big change
mm-hmm,
in the
mm-hmm.
Portuguese Empire.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think two aspects. One is that I think the tradition of arbitrismo in arbitris is much more strong in Spain than in Portugal. So once you have the Iberian Union, you have the Portuguese embedded in a system which promotes this kind of writing and connecting to the political power and explaining solutions for different problems of society, economy, and so forth. So you have people in different parts of the empire trying to play this game of the arbitrio, right? And they are very, chronologically speaking, they are very strong in this period. Also because it has to do with, first, during Philip II, the need of knowing the Portuguese Empire. You have a lot of things which were written explicitly to inform Philip II about what was the Portuguese Empire. And secondly, with potential reforms of that the Spanish brought to the Portuguese Empire itself. Right? The idea of now you write these materials to inform me in a systematic way, and you add images. And that's the story of the books of Cities and Fortresses. You don't have them before the 1580s, 1590s. And suddenly, everyone is writing to inform Philip II, Philip III in this way. And the example I gave from Sri Lanka is a good one. Sri Lanka became crucial, violent scenario of the Portuguese Empire in Asia in the first half of the late 16th, first half of the 17th century. And the tendency is to send information with pictures to Philip III and IV for them to decide what to do. And that's why you have so many. Even for Sri Lanka, I've published this one from Saragossa in a book called Os Olhos do Rei. And I came across four. The one from Saragossa, I think it's more interesting because it gives you some views outside the fortresses, the ones I have shown to you. But you have four only on Sri Lanka in the 1630s, before the Dutch conquest. The Dutch came in 1638. So you have a native problem because the Kingdom of Kandy is very much violent with the Portuguese. And on the other hand, you have the Dutch coming. So it's a crucial moment in terms of political decision, military strategy, and information. So, yeah. So you came to the...
So... research into scholarship in popular texts. This is a question that has to do with an extrapolating kind of process of thinking. On one hand, thinking of narrative and literature and printed texts and the circulation of these kinds of things, reports. Mm-hmm. But there's been so much scholarship that has invited us to rethink the idea of literacy as being something that was only possible among the elites or widespread mm-hmm. among the elites, and that there are many different levels of literacy mm-hmm. That some might depend partly on illustrations, but that also don't, that have mm-hmm. much to mm-hmm. do with community norms and practices around spreading mm-hmm. The word. Mm-hmm. So my question, knowing that, is, and then turning to part of your argument here mm-hmm. in this talk, you're inviting us to rethink the mm-hmm. whole idea of the rich elite institutional mm-hmm, mm-hmm. cartography and saying these poor cartographic mm-hmm, examples mm-hmm. really should make us reconsider standard narratives of the development of cartography and the purpose of cartography. And I want to ask you, thinking about visual practice and visual knowledge, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I guess the capabilities, does your work with these mm-hmm. images and these codices and mm-hmm. is it making you rethink whatever it is that you had been taught regarding uh-huh. how mm-hmm. people use maps to see the world?
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially with regard to the image of that soldier who was an arbitrista.
No.
I forget, was it Ceylon? I'm forgetting mm-hmm. what mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or even these amazing artists who must have been shipped around mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. ships mm-hmm. all over the place to illustrate these things. Extremely knowledgeable about visual conventions, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. there isn't an art historical practice that really exists, a methodology to really trace kind of production. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So
no, I agree with you. The oral dimension and the oral visual never thought of that in a consistent way. But I think the number of things that you said that I think present in my argument. One is this, the idea of literacy, as you said. You have a number of and again, one of the things I like to do is to look at lists of books in 17th century libraries that do not exist anymore. And you see stuff that you'd like to have as an historian today, and that's not there. But you seem like the one you said, the one on Sri Lanka, people presenting themselves as veteran soldiers who are not really intellectual people, far from that. But you have a lot of texts like that, people writing with where the classical legacy is not very crucial, not very present, or second-hand, third-hand references to the Greeks and the Romans. Sometimes you have a lot of that. And you come across a number of examples then, existing ones or listed in libraries, 17th century Iberian libraries, it's the ones I know most about, where this soldier wrote this on, and people that you see that belong to the lower strata of nobility, placed in these colonial cities, and able to write and with the curiosity to systematically write on a certain topic. One of the side projects I have with a Portuguese colleague of mine, a literary scholar, is to publish 17th century, a couple of 17th century dialogues on Sri Lanka, fictional ones again. One was published in English, and the other one was never published. So in Portuguese, none of these two were published. And one is very interesting because it's published by a Sinhalese who became a Catholic priest. And then you can trace the problem of sort of double identity. You have someone who knows a lot about Buddhism but became a Catholic and a Catholic priest. So and he knows a lot about the society where he came from. And he has secondhand references to Portugal where we have never been. He has never been. So this is one. The other one is he presents himself as a veteran soldier. But he knows a lot. He's one of the actors, one of the two characters is named Cardenio, Cardinio, right? From Shakespeare. And then at some point he said, the other one asks him, why don't you write about this? And he said, I cannot write more than this dialogue because the King of Kandy, I have a sort of portable library and the King of Kandy took all my books. So it's a very sensitive issue, right? To what extent these people are literate to the erudite or not? Uh-huh. And something that I've been thinking about, and I don't have a... but I suspect that you have a lot of people at the lower level of the nobility with a number of very interesting intellectual tools, and they use them in this period, in the senses that we have, that I have tried to show.
I think that you are, your argument, at least in the paper that you presented today, is very suggestive of that. It seems that you have a lot of really good evidence to work with to go in that direction.
And not to mention these hybrid people like Heredia, right? Someone was born in Malacca and able to connect between different worlds.
I was thinking of an example, a well-known example, and I was wondering how it would fit in your project, in your argument. As I was looking at the Casamentense
codex,
the illustrations from the codex, I was thinking of another instance of depictions of the Portuguese by Asian people,
yeah,
in this case, the rich tradition of the Namban screens in Japan. With the addition that, you know, the term Namban, as far as I know, means southern barbarians, right? So where the Portuguese are represented as not necessarily savages, but certainly non-Japanese. So how would that, you know, and at the same time, the Namban screens are not examples of poor metal or any sort of popular art. They were commissioned to artists that were working for the nobility. How would that...
No, I think I think that's something I tried to explore in this small exhibition in Lisbon, then with a brief catalog called the Inverted Mirror, right? The ways in which the Portuguese are depicted in different Asian scenarios, from the Persian Gulf and to Japan and China. And you're right that some of these societies they become the object of very refined artists. Same thing with the example you gave from the Namban screens, the number, the it's a good example. The other one is the Mughal miniatures in the Mughal capital, the Mughal court. You have the best Mughal artists working for successive Mughal emperors depicting the Portuguese or the Jesuits. And you see them in crucial moments of the life, the courtly life. In so the so-called Darbar, when the Mughal emperor appears to his servants, you always see a Jesuit there. It's part of the, it's part of the. And it, I think it doesn't necessarily have to be, in that case, a sort of distinction between poor and rich. It's something that in some courts and in some societies, Japan, the Jesuits in the Forbidden City, the Jesuits and other Portuguese in the Mughal court, they really made an impression. And they became, actually, they became part, actually, they became part of the courtly system. For the Mughal emperor, as for the Chinese emperor, a Jesuit is part of his court. He's not a European anymore. He's a European because he's exotic, but he doesn't represent. And actually, that's why they are very reluctant on helping the Portuguese. In the sense, sometimes you have Portuguese Jesuits reluctant on making the, in trying to bridge the gap between the two societies, because they know that they are there as intellectuals favored by the emperors, and not as. Even at some point, they realize that they are not missionaries in that sense, missionaries in the court to convert people. They don't. A missionary in the Forbidden City doesn't convert anyone. But he's there because he's a cartographer, he's a mathematician, and then the emperor says, well, I'm going to a hunting expedition to the border in North Korea. Come with me and you will depict the border. And you have Portuguese cartographers doing this in the late 17th, early 18th century. So they are there as intellectuals, as specialists. Someone with whom the emperor is keen on conversing. And the famous religious debates in the Mughal court, when Akbar brings a Jesuit, an Hindu, a Buddhist, a Jew, and says, now speak about religion. And now it tries to play the referee. When the Jesuit is very angry with the mullah, he tries to calm down things, right? So they are incorporated, they are absorbed by a system which is not European anymore, and they know that. And when asked by, and so that visually also they become crucial in that society. That would be my answer. And when the viceroys in Goa ask them to be intermediate, try to mediate. For example, for the Mughal court, for the Mughal mission, they say, we don't write about political stuff. They are really afraid of losing this kind of importance in the Mughal court. And the same thing goes true for Beijing. When the Portuguese ambassadors get there and say, well, now we have people either speaking Portuguese or French or Italian, and they are Jesuits, and they are very reluctant. They try to help them by explaining the Chinese protocol, how many times you have to koto and so forth, but they don't want to interfere too much. And sometimes the Portuguese ambassadors complain, saying, "Well, we have the Jesuits there, but they don't help us." So I would say that they become part of a Asian or different Asian courtly societies in a very strong and central way. And I think that's why also they become the attraction of many artists, very good artists in different societies.
We've actually gone on rather longer than
it's up to you.
I meant to, and this is my fault for not cutting off the interesting discussion we've been having. But let me invite you to stay behind and continue this discussion more informally if you wish. But before we do that, let's give a formal
thank you. Thank you very much for coming.